Welcome to the 111th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. Welcome to the podcast that, in tribute to the great David Shepherd, will be recording this Nelson episode standing on one foot.
Indeed, what would cricket be without these colourful traditions? And this episode, we are talking about colourful traditions galore, really, actually quite coincidentally. So Andy's come into possession of some new wisdoms, which I'm looking forward to hearing about. I recently spent a long weekend in traffic and rediscovered a childhood delight. We're going to be talking about the history of cricket broadcasting on TV in Australia, which is actually more interesting than it sounds, although I did find a PhD thesis on the subject, which sapped all of the joy out of it. And we are going to be reviewing Sherlock Holmes and the Birth of the Ashes. Now, there is a book that David Shepherd would probably have really got into. Now, Andy, there was a beautiful picture you put up on Twitter of a couple of boxes of yellow-spined books that you came into possession of. Tell us about those.
Well, it says a lot, doesn't it, that a couple of boxes of books can earn the adjective beautiful. But I was the lucky beneficiary of a cricket-agnostic friend who had recently inherited this collection of wisdoms and kindly gifted them to me.
Given them by the uncle who wanted them to learn and sort of in one side of the house, out the other side of the house.
Indeed. I think she had looked at it and realised that unless she was going to become a cricket fan very soon, it wasn't worth her giving up, you know, 50% of her bookshelf. Now, like a lot of cricket fans, I've always had this vague intention to start collecting wisdoms. I've got a couple, but I've never really done it systematically. But even before you've opened a page, they are just a joyous sight. You see this legion of smart yellow covers. I dipped at random into the 1997 edition and was soon enjoying Matthew Engel's strong defence of the county championship. And I couldn't help thinking, how many notes from the editors over the years must have been strong defences of the county championship.
It is interesting when you do that thing of going back to looking at what the current concerns of the game were back in the past. We saw this a bit when we were reading the Swanton Arlott book a few episodes ago, when sometimes you see these themes that come back and back. You think, oh, maybe county championship in crisis is something that's new, but then you have something which is a history of previous years and you realise that actually often these are recurring themes that come through the game.
You realise that the game is perpetually in crisis, and nothing more perpetually in crisis than the county game. And wisdoms are there to be distracted by, and I found myself soon thoroughly engaged in a random Derbyshire match report, and I realised that, you know, hours could disappear very quickly here. As you said, I posted a picture of the two boxes on Twitter, and much to my surprise, neither you or me, Toby, are sort of social media ninjas, but much to my surprise, it's had a rather major response. I think by our standards, it's very much gone viral. And the number of people who've just expressed their delight at what is, you know, two apple boxes full of wisdoms has been something of a reminder to me of the special place that wisdoms hold in the affection of cricket fans.
And I think there is something about wisdoms as objects that is so important. You referred to the, you know, the way that you sort of see them all lined up with the yellow spines, but even that kind of slightly unwieldy size that they are, because really they should just expand them to A4 and not have them so thick, because they're kind of as thick as they are tall and wide almost. They're these kind of little blocks, and I certainly have so many memories of kind of cricket pavilions when I was a schoolboy with rows of wisdoms in the, you know, along the walls. And even as objects, let alone when you've actually opened the covers, they evoke something from the past, I think.
No, you're quite right. There is a real joy in their impracticality. You know, even picking one up and reading from one is fundamentally a bit inconvenient. Now, you said you rediscovered a childhood joy while stuck in traffic. I mean, there is relatively little joy to be had stuck in traffic. So where did this discovery come from?
Where did it come from? Yeah, so we went away for the Easter long weekend and ended up stuck in a car for a couple of hours. And in the glove box, much to my delight, I'd forgotten. You know how you lose stuff in the glove box and underneath a kind of old rag and the instruction book for the windscreen wipers? You sometimes find little treasures. Well, it wasn't a £10 note. It was the best of 12th man compilation, CD compilation. And now I reacted with greater joy towards this than my partner, who kind of rolled her eyes slightly. But before long, we were just absolutely both, you know, rolling with delight. And it was the first time that I'd actually heard 12th Man for a number of years. I grew up listening to it quite a lot. Although I'm surprised listening to it now that my parents let me, because it is pretty, there are some language warnings inherent in it. And famously, Richie Beno used to write reviews of each episode and write back to Billy Birmingham, who was the guy who created it. And said, yes, you know, it's marvelous in the words of Richie Beno, but, you know, could do with a bit less swearing. And there is a lot of swearing, but there's also a lot of brilliant cricketing insight that comes along with it. It's that joyous thing of listening to something and kind of feeling like you're speaking the same language as it, because there are so many little in-jokes that happen along the way, all the way from the way that, you know, the Sri Lankan cricketers are pronounced to, you know, commentary on some of the idiosyncrasies and quirks of particularly English cricketers during the 1990s. The other thing that really struck me is remembering anew that every single voice in that in the 12th Man is Billy Birmingham, the guy who created it. And there is this extraordinary range of voices. And I don't know whether he did them all separately and spliced them together or was kind of switching from one to the other in real time. But it is amazing when you listen to it thinking this was one guy recording all of this. You do actually suddenly appreciate the sheer talent of someone who can carry off not only that range of accents, but that range of personas as well.
What is so lovely to hear is that there are so many childhood joys that when rediscovered in adulthood prove to be deeply disappointing, because you discover that actually as a child you were totally lacking in discretional taste, and actually that film, song, whatever that you loved, it is in fact terrible. It is a rare joy, as you say, to find this thing in the glove compartment and say, no, it's just as good, even if not even better. Has it as a whole aged well, would you say? Like, is it the kind of thing that, you know, you could give to sort of, you know, the young, hip cricket fan of today and they would enjoy?
I think that one of the things that hasn't aged well is that a lot of the jokes depend on you knowing the people. So there's a brilliant episode where Benno advises Tony Gregg to go off and get a wig and Bill Laurie to go and get a nose job so that they can both look better on TV for commentating, for being the captains of the commentary team. And you kind of need to know who they are in order for that to be really... in order for that to work when you're hearing it on the radio. But there's also a whole lot of other aspects and a whole lot of jokes around just cricket per se, which do come across pretty well. And I think one thing that really carries it is the fact that the legend of Richie Beno is so strong that he has entered the popular consciousness of cricket in such a big way that everyone for generations will know who Richie is.
From the archives, and this episode, Toby is going to take us on a ramble through the history of cricket on Australian TV.
Now, you know, sometimes when you're sitting of an evening flicking through the internet and you come across some slightly extraordinary stuff. Well, I was doing that the other day and I came across a doctoral thesis on the subject of not just of cricket broadcasting on Australian TV, but actually the technical infrastructure and developments that went into making it happen. Now, this was a PDF of some sort of 400 pages or something like that. I would not necessarily recommend it as holiday reading. A lot of it went straight over my head and involved, you know, graphs and numbers and things that I don't really do. But there were some fascinating insights into the way that cricket on TV developed in Australia, and actually how cricket on TV drove the development of technology as much as the development of technology drove cricket on TV. So indulge me while I give you a bit of a snapshot, the distilled highlights of this 400-page doctoral thesis. So
I'm just delighted that that this was an appropriate doctoral thesis topic. I know a couple of friends who've embarked and some who've even finished the path of a PhD, and I can say that all of them have done things that have added less value to the world than this fine PhD.
And I hope they're all listening. It was in the early 1930s that the Australian Broadcasting Corporation began broadcasting test matches on the radio across Australia. And from quite early on, they were able to bring Test cricket to every corner of Australia. Australia as a continent is a really difficult country to broadcast in. I actually work in radio broadcasting at the moment, so I have a bit of insight into this, even in 2019, how difficult it is. But what was worked out pretty quickly was how to get medium wave radio across all of the states in Australia. And so actually radio commentary was prioritized for cricket, and cricket was able to be brought across the country. It wasn't until about 20 years later, in 1957, that the first ever test match was broadcast on TV. And this was a broadcast that happened out of Brisbane. It was the first test of the 1957-58 Ashes. And what's wonderfully ironic about this is that whilst the broadcast was coming out of Brisbane, Brisbane at that time actually had no access to TVs. There was no TV transmission in Brisbane. So if you were in Brisbane, then you couldn't actually watch this. And this is important for another reason that I'll come to. Now, what was interesting is that when this was first broadcast on TV in around Australia from the Brisbane Test, it actually was the thing that drove the powers that be to start thinking seriously about expanding TV coverage to the rest of Australia. They suddenly saw the popularity of this, and they thought, oh, this thing called TV, which we thought may not take off because, you know, radio is really the thing that everyone's interested in and not many people have TV sets. Suddenly, when the cricket started being broadcast on TV, they thought, oh, maybe there's something in this. Maybe people will catch on to this. Now, just one piece of context, which is at the time, cinemas were actually booming quite significantly. It's the kind of golden age of Hollywood. Fred Astaire was doing his thing around this time. And everyone was thinking cinema is the thing to do. People go out, they dress up for it, but TV isn't something that's ever going to catch on. And suddenly it was cricket that actually started changing that.
The funny thing about this is there's something of a recurrent theme here where major events in kind of the history of TV, and as you said, that, you know, the history of radio, have so often been sporting or royal, haven't they? They've had sort of coronation, whatever, which is sort of been very crucial. But it is interesting, isn't it? You know, sometimes we kind of people can roll their eyes about the role of sport in society. Is it too predominant, etc., etc.? But it's this fact that often it's this these iconic moments that an entire nation decides they have to watch this thing, and suddenly, as you say, the technology almost has to catch up.
Well, and there were concerns about the fact that there were entire nations that wanted to engage with cricket. And interestingly, so it was 5 years earlier that the Ashes was first broadcast on TV in England. And there are a couple of concerns that came around that from a kind of from a cricketing point of view and from a moral point of view. So from a cricketing point of view, the MCC were really worried that crowds would not turn up and watch the game if it was broadcast on TV. Now, think how far we've come, where we now have the argument around if cricket is not on free-to-air television, then the crowds will dwindle. So we've now got to the stage of saying we need more and more access to the game rather than less, whereas back in the day there was this concern that actually by putting it on TV, no one would actually turn up and watch the game itself, which is ironic when you watch some of the footage from those times, and you can't actually, you know, you can hardly see the ball, and the, you know, zoom lenses aren't too advanced, so everyone, you know, is sort of an inch high in the far distance of the screen. The other concern there was is that because initially it wasn't broadcast live, it was broadcast as highlights packages on TV, those highlights packages had to go into the early evening, and that mostly displaced education children's programming. And so people got outraged that suddenly sport was going on TV instead of the educational programming that had been there in the past. For children, there was a sense of, oh, should our children be being brought up watching cricket rather than, you know, whatever other kind of spelling program there was on the
I was going to say, this educational children's programming doesn't instinctively sound very gripping, although maybe I'm doing down the efforts of the fine Aussie TV educationalists.
Well, there was the question about what was more gripping was actually answered by the moral police, who came out. There was a report at the time which I'll quote from. It said, "It is disrupting a nation's work and could even leave a mark on the economy. For the first time, millions, compared with thousands before, are watching. In many offices, workers stopped or being disrupted seriously by workers sneaking to the nearest TV set. What is to be done about it? Nobody seems to know. The craze will certainly spread." And if events continue to thrill the populace as these tests have done, there is no knowing how much work will be disrupted. So there was suddenly this idea that the nation would grind to a halt because cricket was on TV.
On the side of the moral police here, it would be a fascinating PhD for someone else to do. The cumulative working hours lost by those following cricket remotely, whether by, you know, radio, TV, or of course now that the
updating the cricket loved, info or the Guardian
exactly,
over
exactly the live yep. the over by over. I mean, God, it'd be terrifying. I mean, I reckon across a single organisation or company, the stats are pretty terrifying. So
I mean, during an Ashes test, I mean, certainly my actual working hours go down by about 70%.
I know, and in the entire organisation grinds to a halt, doesn't it? So perhaps the moral police were right, although
exactly. But now the genie's out of the bottle. Now, what certainly has got easier over time is actually the technical side of how cricket is broadcast on TV. Now, I'm not going to take you through in as much detail as this PhD did about this, but there are a couple of interesting facts. One of which is that in the early days, there were only in Australia a couple of broadcasting towers that could actually broadcast content, and so what they had to do was send the footage from Brisbane to a transmission tower in Brisbane, and then from there back to a studio in Sydney. It was there that they would cut up all of the footage and put together a highlights reel, and they would then broadcast it from Sydney around the country. And one thing that they weren't able to do at that point was to broadcast to capture and broadcast live sound. And so what they had to do was to basically fake all of the crowd sounds, so they'd just have some kind of, you know, crowd Atmos in a can somewhere that they just underlay. But the best piece of trivia around this is that, of course, they wanted to give the sense of, you know, the bat hitting the ball when the batsman was hitting a glorious cover drive. And the way that this was done was that there was a poor kind of intern who used to sit there with a microphone, a pencil, and a cigar box, and every time a shot was taken, he would tap the cigar box with the pencil, and that would be the sound of the ball hitting the bat. So all of those people around the country who were in raptures about the glorious sound of leather on Willow were actually in the first instance listening to a guy called Hans Pomerantz, who'd fled Nazi Germany. He'd actually escaped from the Holocaust, listening to him tapping a cigar box with a pencil. I mean, how evocative is that?
It's wonderful for so many reasons. I mean, the low-tech sort of aspect of it is wonderful. What intrigues me is why the answer to this question of how do we get the sound of a ball hitting bat isn't to record the sound of a ball hitting a bat and then superimpose that. But that response was obviously far too prosaic and dull for the...
Interestingly, because apparently I once watched a documentary about special effects in Hollywood, not to digress too much, but what they say is that you can actually get much more realistic sounds of certain things by constructing them without those things that are involved. So if you want to get the sound of someone punching someone else, what you don't do is just, you know, record someone punching someone else. You need to do it in a really kind of imaginative way that gets towards what we think the sound is rather than what the sound actually is. Now, I'm not sure that the pencil in the cigar box sounds suspiciously like it was just, oh, what's lying around that we can hit together. I don't think there was too much science that went behind this. But certainly it was an era where people were, I think, in a way, just fundamentally making it up as they went along. What is interesting is that it might not have been that that this did stick. I talked about the fact that the popularity of cricket on TV drove a lot of the technological developments that happened. But actually, that wasn't necessarily a given, because that first test from Brisbane that was broadcast turned out to be one of the most boring test matches that's kind of ever been played. And it still holds the distinction of having the slowest ever 50 in not only test cricket but first class cricket. So good old Trevor Barnacle Bailey, who was the English opener, scored 50 from 350 balls in 357 minutes. So if ever you want compelling TV cricket viewing, I think you weren't getting it in that game. The review, and for this episode we have been reading Sherlock Holmes and the Birth of the Ashes by Arunabha Sengupta. It was a book published a few years ago in 2015. Sengupta is a cricket historian and chief cricket writer at cricketcountry.com. He's also the author of three previous novels: Labyrinth, which is a novel about the software industry, Big Apple Two Bites, and the bestseller. I can't confess to having read any of those other books. When I first picked up this book, which sort of does what it says on the tin, it's a pastiche Sherlock Holmes book. It's set at the 1882 Oval Test, the game that went on to sort of create the Ashes, but he writes Sherlock Holmes into that narrative. When I first picked it up, I sort of feared the worst. Do you think I was justified?
I think there was an awful lot that could have gone wrong here. So I think Sherlock Holmes is so pastiched. I mean, I was just thinking off the top of my head. You know, I know that, for example, you know, Anthony Horowitz did a very sort of painstaking recently a Sherlock Holmes of his own. I remember listening as a child to a radio comedy that was extremely bad called Second Holmes, that was about what Sherlock Holmes's grandson and Watson's grandson taking up the family business. There's, of course, the BBC series. You know, in short, a lot of people have tried to follow in Conan Doyle's footsteps. And combining that with cricket does feel like a sort of high-risk activity. But it's rather good. And I think it's rather good partly because it's clearly driven by a sort of passion for the subject. It has a true sort of Holmesian plot. It is a little bit mad and a little bit ridiculous, but it's also very carefully constructed. And you have several of those, that's clever moment that, you know, characterise a sort of a good Conan Doyle. And of course, the cricket history itself comes in. And I mean, for you, did that work? Did that combination of Holmes and the world of cricket work?
So the way that it's set up is that Holmes is the... you know, he's obviously the detective. He's there. He's interested in the mystery. Watson is his sidekick, is the cricket, you know, the diehard cricket tragic fanatic, who's desperately following the series, but kind of gets drawn into the plot of the novel as well as the plot of the test match too. I actually thought that they came together surprisingly well, and there were some, you know, quite interesting little touches in the novel that I haven't actually researched to see whether they were true, but some sort of little touches of colour about the Oval at that time and the way the cricket was played at that time that do actually make you sort of immerse you in the scene a bit. Clearly Sengupta is, and you know, as I said at the top, he is a, you know, he's a chief cricket writer at Cricket Country. Clearly he knows his cricket and loves his cricket, and I think that really helps because it does engage with the cricket properly as well. The other thing I think around the plot is that you think you've got it sussed out, you think you know where it's going, and you know there is a moment where you think, oh, it's all been for the sake of, you know, a fairly simplistic ending, but then there's a beautiful twist in the tale as well that comes through, which is around the Criado. They're coming for you, Andy. We can hear the police in the background. There's a beautiful twist in the tale that comes right at the very end as well, which is something that we won't spoil now.
Yeah, that is a wonderful example of a really nice kind of well-engineered sort of clever plot twist, and yeah, a lot of care has gone into structuring it. I think as a cricket fan, you know, all of us know, you know, the story of that 1882 test. And I think one of the fun things about it is following it from the perspective, as you say, of Holmes and Watson. And you have these rather odd moments where these familiar historic figures kind of pop up in the story. So I enjoy the kind of very nervous Charlie Studd turning up just before his sort of ill-fated second innings, and there's lots of moments where you sort of nod happily to yourself as another famous figure makes an appearance. We have Grace's brother, WG's brother, E.M. Grace. He's challenged by Sherlock Holmes, who says, you know, basically, why are you focusing on the cricket where a man has just died? And he says, why, Mr. Holmes, here is a case of death. Out there is a matter of life and death. There is life in the match yet, but this man cannot be helped. Which is somehow wonderful and almost believable. And the style itself, in the same way that Sengupta has taken care over the plot to structure a plausibly Holmesian plot, he's taken care with the language, and it's very excessive and flowery. But then, you know, that's very Conan Doyle, and it's very much the sort of overwrought, overdone sentences. And you can see the sort of care and affection that has gone into that as well.
The other thing that I would say, which is, you know, this sounds like damning with faint praise, but I think it's just the right length too. It's what, a couple of hundred pages long. It's the kind of thing that you can read in a couple of sittings in the, you know, in your deck chair with a glass of Pimm's or however one cares to read. But you do sort of roar through it. I never found that there is really a sort of a dull moment. And I think that often with these sorts of labors of love, that's quite an important aspect.
I agree, and actually, again, very true to many of Conan Doyle's finest stories and finest novels, that actually he kept them brief. He was not, for the most part, a rambler. You know, you had a lot of stuff that was basically integral to the plot and integral to the structure. So I think, as we touched on at the start, you know, there are many ways in which this could have gone wrong. I think we were both kind of very curious in the sense that we don't review much fiction, which I think, you know, we're in an interesting position that cricket has this astonishing literature, but it is overwhelmingly in the non-fiction format. You know, we're open to recommendations and open to discovering more, but it doesn't have, you know, as far as we know, a very extensive fiction library. But Sengupta's love of cricket and his love of Conan Doyle and his attention to detail sees him pull off what I think is, as we said, an ambitious idea. I think if you're a fan of both of those things, this will be a real treat. If you're not, I think steer clear, because I think you'll be deeply mystified by almost everything that goes on every page.
Well, there we go. That's a good closing line for the book review. He might quote that on the cover of his next book. So that is Sherlock Holmes and the Birth of the Ashes. It's a good fun read. I think we just got it off the internet, as it were. I'm not sure who it's even published published by. It's published by a publisher in the Netherlands. There you go. Best Mysteries. So Sherlock Holmes and the Birth of the Ashes, and that was the 111th episode of Reverse Prep Radio. We're both, Andy, you still standing on one leg?
Indeed.
I'm still on one leg. Look at that for a balancing act. We will release our other leg and see you for episode 112 before long.